Hello, Classic Rock.
Yeah, hi, this is Daniel Buckspan. I have an interview with you now.
You do. How you doing, Daniel?
Good, how are you?
I am doing excellent. Do I call you Dan or Daniel?
Daniel. I go by professionally.
Okay.
My friends call me Hey You.
And Buckspan is the proper pronunciation?
That is it.
All right, perfect. Well, I am ready to talk Rush if you are.
I am.
All right, here we go. We have a special guest joining us now. We've got rock historian and author Daniel Buckspan joining us, who has written a new book called Rush and 2112, 50 Years. That book is in stores and available at Amazon. Daniel, thank you for taking some time to chat Rush with us this morning.
Oh, absolutely. Happy to be here.
Would it be fair to call you a Rush aficionado? I understand you're a big fan.
The only time I've ever corrected anyone on anything like that is when I get called a Rush expert, because I know the fans would start rioting if I was the expert. But I'll take aficionado, I'll take fan, I'll take enthusiast, all of that stuff.
Can you give me a little snapshot of what the book is filled with?
Oh, yeah, sure. It's in three sections. And the first section, pretty much talks about the band's history leading up to that record. The second section is an analysis, like track-by-track analysis of the record. And the third and final section, really talks about the effect that record had on their career going forward. It's kind of like a three-act play, you could say. And, it was a lot of fun to write. I learned a lot of stuff writing it. And when I thought already, I had kind of exhausted it all with Rush at 50. And it was just a pleasure from start to finish to put that thing together.
Did you get special access to the band when putting this together?
No, not at all. I've never asked for it. I don't want it. And if it happens, I would want that to come from them. I will not solicit them because to me, I respect them too much. And I sort of consider them people who are still in grieving. Even though it's a few years later, I think they're still grieving for Neil, which is actually why I think they're going back out on tour, is to kind of deal with that process. I would just not want to be, some guy pounding on their door for access.
Sure.
I was lucky, though, to be able to speak to people who did work with them and know them and kind of speak for them somewhat.
So you got indirect access.
Yeah, I spoke to Terry Brown, their longtime co-producer. He co-produced 2112. I talked to Hugh Syme, who did all their album covers. And I talked to Donna Halper, who discovered them and worked alongside them at Mercury Records when they were making 2112.
This project was Rush's fourth album after the first three had a moderate success, if you can call it that. But this album was different, and it really kind of pushed them to the forefront of 70s rock. Do you know the story of how this album came to be, the concept behind it?
Well, Neil is a big reader, as everyone knows. He just always had his face buried in a book all the time. And the story of the 2112 suite on side one is sort of very loosely based on this Ayn Rand novella called Anthem. The stories are not really the same, but the theme, is basically the individual against conformity. Other than that, the stories are really not that related, but, he saw fit to thank her in the liner notes anyway, so there was no confusion. But the story, as Neil wrote it, is, completely original. You might compare it a little bit to 1984 by George Orwell, but it's still, all the details of the character of the anonymous narrator, the priests of the temples of Syrinx, those all come from him. Those are all his ideas, and they're wonderful, detailed little ideas. And that's all from him. I'm sure he had little influences here and there that maybe we don't know about. But that's all him, as far as I can see it.
And so in the book, you kind of break down the different segments of not only the 2112 suite, but then the other side of the album, too.
Yeah, those are those those are bangers, by the way. The songs on side two, which are, you know, like 3 and 4 minute songs, sometimes don't get as much attention as, you know, the suite on side one, you know, for obvious reasons.
Mm-hmm.
But to me, side two is 100% as strong as side one. There is no filler anywhere on that record that I've ever heard. Like, there's not a second of it that's wasted. And, you know, I would describe it as, you know, really one of the few perfect albums that's out there where you don't skip anything. That's so rare. You know, every record has at least like one dud on it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So many of our favorite records would have been perfect, but for, you know, this thing or whatever. I cannot say that about this record. Everything needs to be there that is there, and it's perfect. And they nailed it, absolutely. In the words of producer Terry Brown, they nailed it. That's what he said about the record, and I agree with him.
I would agree, too. I don't think I've ever lifted the needle when listening to that album.
Yeah, and I mean, even if you were going to, you know, the songs you would be skipping are like 3 minutes long and, you know, not like, this, you know, this huge onus to sit through. But it's all great. You know, I mean, I guess the songs that get the least attention are probably Tears and Lessons, but those are great tunes. And Twilight Zone is great. Something for Nothing is my favorite song on the album. You know, there's incredible stuff there. Also, since I'm a total pothead, I have, you know, great fondness for Passage to Bangkok. Just all of it is great. And again, it is rare that you're going to get that from anybody, but, you know, from all 39 minutes are essential.
We are talking with Daniel Buxban, who is a rock historian and author. His new book is out now called Rush and 2112, 50 Years. You can find that in stores and at Amazon or wherever you get your books. What do you think it is about this progressive album as it came out? You know, other bands had been doing concept albums. The Who had Tommy, came out a few years prior to this. Was it, do you think, intended to be kind of a concept album, or did it just kind of work out that way?
Everyone calls it a concept album, even though the concept is limited to side one. You could call it a concept side, I guess. But everyone calls it a concept album. Everyone also calls it a progressive rock album. I don't even consider it a progressive rock album. I consider it a hard rock album with progressive tendencies. The real progressive stuff to me is the two records that came after, you know, Farewell to Kings and Hemispheres. But I'm not going to argue with anybody who is like, that's a progressive rock concept album, because they're not wrong either. You know, and the stuff on side two, which is not necessarily related to the concept on side one, is still part of the whole package. And, you know, when you listen to side two, it really complements what you heard on the first side. You know, side one is like very heavy and serious and dense. And, you know, and then they're giving you like, you know, kind of lighter, you know, sunnier stuff on the other side. And you, taken all together, it's all essential. So, you know, I mean, I'm not going to argue too much with anyone who wants to say either concept album or progressive rock. They're not wrong.
Your take on this, what do you think it is that Rush has in the mix that's helped them maintain all these years later? You know, they haven't put out new material in quite some time, but there's huge talk about this 50-something tour. People are really excited for this tour this summer. What do you think it is that that is the key for them?
All of that music is of an incredibly high quality, incredibly timeless, and they always made sure that they changed with every record. So they have this incredibly rich, diverse catalog that, you know, wherever you are in life, whatever your age is, wherever you're coming from, there's something in that catalog that you can relate to. You know, I mean, I know people who first heard Rush because of Clockwork Angels, which is wild to me, but there are people where that's their entry point, was their final album. There are people whose favorite album is Hold Your Fire. You know, the whole catalog, you know, whoever you are, whatever you're interested in, there's something there. There's something you can attach yourself to. You know, and I mean, I know that there are eras of the band that some people don't care for as much as others. But, you know, you take it all as a whole, and just what you've got is this really adventurous band that really keeps you guessing. And the fact that these are the, you know, three absolutely world-class musicians who are just fun to watch play, that goes a really long way too. You know, I mean, but yeah, I mean, the short answer is it's the music.
It's kind of weird to think about bands that have been around for 50 some years. They have massive lineup changes. Rush never really had to deal with that. You know, Neil Peart wasn't the original drummer, but they didn't have people coming and going over all those years, which is really quite unique to them.
It's really unusual. And, you know, they're all really tight friends also, like on a personal level. You know, and I've been saying it to other people. I will say it to you. I do not have to name the many bands that I'm sure you're aware of where it's really one or two people are, you know, the big enchilada, the ones really in charge, and they hate each other. But, you know, they keep the band going anyway. And, you know, so it's these two people who hate each other and a revolving door of sidemen, you know. I'm sure I don't have to name any of them for you. I'm sure you're thinking of like 50 of them right now.
Mm-hmm.
You know? But the fact that they had just a really good personal relationship and really respected each other, you know, that not only, you know, speaks to their longevity, but also just like that they're decent guys and, you know, it's worth staying together with them. You know, they were always friends first. Everyone I spoke to on both books said that, you know, and they, very early on in their career, they made a decision that they were just, you know, no matter who wrote the song, no matter what the arrangement was, they were just going to split all songwriting royalties three ways, 33% each, because they didn't want it to have an effect on their friendship. That is a big deal. You know, I think you can count on one hand, you know, the successful bands who've had that kind of a relationship. There's just not a lot of that out there. So, it's, you know, it's just another thing about them that makes them uniquely them.
We're talking with Daniel Buxpan, who is a rock historian and author. His new book, Rush and 2112, 50 Years, is available now. Personal question about Neil Peart. Maybe you know the answer to this. Maybe you don't. He didn't like riding the tour bus. And I think a lot of people know he was a big, avid motorcyclist. Do you know, did he actually really ride to a lot of gigs on his own?
He did that on a bicycle for a while before he became like a motorcyclist. He would ride from gig to gig on a bicycle because, like you said, he just hated the tour bus and he just needed to change up. You know, it's touring is such a grind. And, you know, he was really the first one to kind of get tired of it. And he was even talking in 1983 about wanting to stop. You know, and I mean, again, any touring musician you talk to, the number one thing they'll say is the hardest part of all of it is keeping going on the road. You know, and these guys sometimes had, there was one string of dates that they had that was 21 nights in a row. I mean, that's crazy. And that will really grind you down. So, you know, for him, I think keeping, you know, exercising, keeping physically fit, having fresh air, you know, and getting even, you know, even though I was saying what good friends all these guys were, getting a little time away from them too, you know, that was probably very helpful. And that probably did a lot to help them stay together. Was Neil and Getty were not intimidated or put off by the fact, I'm sorry, Alex and Getty, sorry, were not intimidated or put off by the fact that Neil was kind of a bit of a lone wolf. You know, they were comfortable with that. They were okay with that.
We've got Daniel Buxpan joining us, author and rock historian. The new book, Rush and 2112, 50 Years, is available now to the month of when that album came out 50 years ago. But this is not the only book you've written. You wrote another book about Rush called Rush at 50.
Yep.
You've written a book about Ozzy Osbourne, a book about Woodstock. So you kind of cover the gamut. What's next for you? What else are you working on?
Oh, my next book comes out in November, and it's called Heavy Metal's Big Four. It's about Metallica, Anthrax, Slayer, and Megadeth. And then after that, I have something scheduled for 2027 that I cannot talk about.
Daniel, I know we're very short on time, so I got to let you go. I do appreciate your time here this morning. Looking forward to checking out the book for myself. It's called Rush and 2112, 50 Years, available now in stores and at Amazon. Do you have social media where people can follow you?
Yeah, I'm on Facebook and Instagram, and I also, there's my official website, notoriousbuk.com.
Daniel, thank you again for your time. I do appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you very much for having me.